This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Elysium Fire, written by Alistair Reynolds, read by John Lee. From a distance, it almost looked natural. A planet with a ring. A world of ochre and mustard clouds, with nothing of the surface visible. A poisonous place, peevishly inimical to human habitation. One shriveled moon. 10 billion such worlds clotted the galaxy, useless to all but the most desperate of species and civilizations. The conjunction of planet and rings was not, in itself, worthy of note. It was the natural business of things where gravity had its way with rubble and ice. Granted, it was more usual to find rings around gas giants rather than a small rocky planet like this one. But even the tiniest of worlds might lay temporary claim to a ring system, if a moon or asteroid fell too deeply into their gravity well. Gravitational dynamics being what they were, though, such a ring system would not endure more than a few million years. This ring system was much younger even than that. Young because it was the work of people, not celestial mechanics. They had come here in vast starships, crossing the Gulf of Light-years from Earth. Down in the permanent ochre murk of Yellowstone's toxic atmosphere, they had founded Chasm City, the greatest urban settlement in human history. And in a girdle around Yellowstone, an adornment to the metropolis below, they had set into orbit 10,000 artificial worlds, each an exquisite fabulation of rock and metal and glass, each with its own name and customs, each bountiful with air and water and a teeming cargo of people. They called this circling river of worlds the Glitter Band, and at the peak of its glory it was home to 100 million living souls. The worlds coexisted in peace, for the most part. The people were as grudgingly content as the truly free will ever be. Wealth and power were in almost limitless abundance. Matter and energy danced to human whims. Even death itself was in slow, stubborn retreat. There was no militia, no standing army. Weapons were rarely glimpsed, rarely spoken of. Crimes were exotic Olympian achievements, crimes of passion even more so. Few social tensions arose because each world was allowed to choose its own destiny, its own political and administrative path. Citizens could move between worlds as they wished, selecting the environment that best met their desires. The only binding law was the iron rule of universal suffrage. Flawless, incorruptible machinery ensured each citizen had their say, not just from year to year, but from day to day, hour to hour. Citizens were polled on every conceivable matter. The process of participation became as habitual as breathing. It was a dream of democracy. But, unlike most dreams, it worked. Or at least most of the time. Occasionally there was a fault in the polling systems, or a tiny loophole that some unscrupulous faction tried to exploit. This became a minor but nagging problem. And so the worlds of the Glitter Band agreed to create a monitoring task force, a small independent body of trusted officials who would be free of ties to any one world, who would not themselves have the vote, but who would operate solely to keep the machinery of mass participation running smoothly, inviolably. They were called prefects. They were assigned a tiny, pumpkin-faced world of their own, scarcely more than a hollowed-out boulder. And it was named Panoply. So small was the scale of the problem that at first it was believed that fewer than 100 prefects would be needed. Eventually, after some resistance, their numbers were permitted to rise to just below 1,000. They were given vehicles, monitoring instruments, some limited forms of enforcement. One prefect for every 10 worlds. One prefect for every 100,000 citizens. It did not seem sufficient, but it was, and for decades the prefects went about their work almost without attention. They were never liked, never welcomed, but they were very rarely required to use the powers at their disposal. When they did, it was always as a last resort. But then the time had come when the prefects had to do something terrible. To save the Glitter Band, it had been necessary to kill part of it. Chapter 1 Late that evening, high in the shell house, just before drowsiness snatched him to unconsciousness, he stirred from his bed and moved to the window. Fingers of orange and russet light played through the shutters, accompanied by a distant crackling and hissing that rose and fell in tide-like waves. Cautiously, struck by some faint sense of impropriety, he opened the shutters on the glassless window and took a breath. The evening air flooded his lungs, sooty with combustion products. He coughed, a sudden human sound that seemed louder than it had any right to be, and then stifled any further coughing with his hand. Across the grounds, far from the shell house, but still within the family dome, on the edge of Chasm City, something was on fire. He watched it, mesmerized and troubled. There was a glow, concentrated in a small area, and hemmed in by a darker mass of trees and vegetation that obscured the heart of the fire. Above the conflagration, the dome panels reflected the glow in dusky variations of the same orange tones he had seen through the shutter. If there was a fire in the grounds, but no, he thought, there was no danger of such a thing taking hold and spreading. Automatic sprinkler systems would cut in long before the flames posed any risk to the shell house itself. And besides, his father would have programmed Lurcher to detect fire and take immediate action to extinguish it. The only curious thing was that the robot had not already done so. Then he caught a movement above the tree line, silhouetted against the glow. A metallic arm, sweeping into view before returning to concealment. Puzzled, certain of what he had seen, but not understanding its significance, he watched and watched, while slowly drawing the shutters, until he peered out through a single, furtive slit. Presently the glow grew less intense. The crackles and hisses ebbed to silence. The smells faded, as the air in the dome was subjected to its usual circulation and filtering process. Still, he observed, certain the evening's mystery was not over. He did not have long to wait. Lurcher emerged from the dense cover of the inner part of the gardens. The robot strolled nonchalantly, silver legs scissoring, two of its four silver arms swinging. In the other pair it carried buckets of tools, as it often did when attending to its gardening chores. From the domed head at the top of its tall, slender body, a single eye stared ahead with unblinking focus. His instinct was to retreat further back into his darkened room, but if the robot detected that its nocturnal activities were being witnessed, it gave no indication. What was left of the glow guttered out. A red reflection lingered on the dome, fading until only his imagination insisted there was still a trace of it. The fire was out. The thing, whatever it was that had been set alight and allowed to burn, had been consumed. He closed the shutters fully and returned to bed. Under the sheets he coughed the last traces of smoke from his lungs. It was not long before the drowsiness took its hold of him, properly this time, vengefully, almost. But in the last moments of clear consciousness, a distinct certainty formed in his mind. A white tree had stood where the fire had been. A dead white tree, hollow to the core, in which he had once liked to play. Talia Eng would have preferred not to have an audience while she worked. That was not the way it was happening, though. A small party of civic functionaries were in attendance, watching in a loose semicircle while she completed the routine upgrade that was her day's business in the Shiga Mint's spindle. "And we're done," she said, as the core began to sink back down into its pit, status symbols confirming the upgrade had proceeded without difficulty. "You'll be on your way now, then," said the citizen's designated spokesperson, a functionary named Manda. The core was nearly back where it belonged. She eyed it for a few more moments before turning to look at the thin-faced man. "Someone might think you wanted to see the back of me, Citizen Manda."
"It's not that," Manda said, his Adam's apple moving hard.
The polling core sank fully into the floor, an iris whisked shut to seal it from casual tampering.
"Then what?"
"I'll say it if Manda won't," said a tall woman standing just behind Manda. "We don't have to pretend you're welcome here, Prefect.
Of course you can visit and do as you please while you're here. She brushed a hand through long auburn hair, pushing it away from a shrewish face. But that doesn't mean we have to like it. Not after what happened. Not now that we know.
Know what, exactly?
What you're capable of, said another man, emboldened by the woman's outburst. What you'll do when it suits you.
You mean,
Talia said mildly, the lengths we'll go to protect your interests?
It was butchery, said the woman.
It was surgery, Talia corrected, keeping her voice level, uninflected, unintimidated. It's no good arguing with them, someone muttered. They've got a justification for everything. They could murder us all and still say it was in the shining name of democracy. It was just a spasm, but Talia felt her fingers switch for the handle of her whip-hound, still holstered on her belt. If you don't like democracy, Talia said, then you're in the wrong solar system.
As if we have a choice, sneered the woman.
There's always a choice, a red-faced man said. They'd just rather none of us were aware of it. But maybe it's time to consider the unthinkable. Maybe it's been time ever since they showed their true colours. We all know what's possible if enough of us take a stand. Panoply won't intervene now. They're too afraid.
Be grateful you'll never need our intervention, Talia said. But if you did, you'd still have it. You don't have to like us to count on us.
It was an old line, one she had picked up from Dreyfus. Something buzzed in her ear. She pressed a finger against her earpiece, squeezing it.
Eng, it's Sparva, she heard. Talia, drop whatever you're doing. Even if the core's still exposed, leave it. We'll secure it remotely. Are there citizens with you?
She eyed the civic functionaries, feeling the full needling pressure of their suspicion and distrust.
Yes, and they have been most hospitable. What's the...
She was about to say problem, but prefects never spoke of problems, at least not in public.
What's required of me, Prefect Bancal?
There's a situation inside the habitat. I'm passing coordinates to your whip-hound. It'll proceed ahead of you and secure the area. It was probably some kind of civic disturbance, a citizen mob or something the local constables were not equipped to handle.
I'll be right behind it. Not immediately. Return to your ship. There's a containment vessel in the aft stowage compartment. Retrieve it. Break out a second whip-hound and follow it to the first.
Her hand moved back to the whip-hound. Nothing about this was part of the plan for visiting Shiga Mintz. It was an in-and-out, all perfectly routine. Nothing about second whip-hounds or cases in stowage compartments.
Prefect Bancal. Get on it, Tal. When I say every second counts, I mean it.
She drew the whip-hound's handle from her holster. In its stowed form, the whip-hound, an autonomous robot whip with enforcement, detainment, and evidence acquisition capabilities, was a black, grip-coated rod, about the size and thickness of a truncheon, inset with a battery of twist controls at one end. On sensing its removal from the holster, the whip-hound extended its roving filament, pushing out a thin, silver tentacle until it made contact with the ground. The tentacle stiffened along its length and formed a snake-like traction coil at the point where it met the floor. A single bright red eye glared from the other end of the handle. The whip-hound had gone from being an inert tool on her belt to a thing that was alive, purposeful, and more than a little intimidating.
"You know what to do," she said. "Go."
The whip-hound nodded its handle and slinked away, picking up speed with a series of sinuous whipping motions. It made a dry whisking sound as it skated across the floor, and the functionaries jerked back to allow it passage. It vanished through the doorway, already moving faster than a person could run. "What's going on?" asked Manda, as if he had every right to an explanation. She ignored him, still pressing a finger to her earpiece.
"Whip-hound deployed, Prefect Bancal. I'm on my way back to the cutter. Quick as you can, Tal."
She took him at his word, leaving the polling corps and the gawping, mystified functionaries behind, breaking into a jog and then a run. She sprinted up a ramp, through a short warren of corridors, into the bright sunlight of civic gardens, past a hissing line of ornamental fountains, up an escalator to a forested plaza, onto a high-speed tram to the dock. She stood on the tram, one hand on the ceiling hoop, as it accelerated away from the stop. It had been 3, maybe 4 minutes since Spava had first contacted her. There were citizens on the tram, watching her with puzzled, worried expressions.
"It's all right," she said, pausing to catch her breath. "This is a local emergency. Nothing to be concerned about."
Panoply must have been pulling strings to override local traffic patterns because the tram made a non-stop sprint for the docking complex. Talia boarded her cutter, the smallest class of Panoply spacecraft, and the only type she was authorized to operate single-handedly, while her hand kept reaching for the whip hand. It felt wrong to be back in the cutter without her weapon. But she opened the aft hatch, craned down to look inside, and found a silver object she didn't recognize. It was a stubby cylinder, about the size of a space helmet, and there was a handle on top of it.
"The silver thing, Spava, I'm presuming?"
"Take it. Your backup whip hound knows where to go." She hoisted the cylinder, then went to the foil-sealed cavity that held the second whip hound. She broke the seal, extracted the whip hound, hefted the heavy black handle for a few moments, and then let it deploy.
"Want to tell me what this is all about?"
"Follow the whip hound. Your first unit is already on site and securing the theater." She left the cutter and headed back into the public spaces of Shiga Mintz, the cylinder dangling from her left hand. It was awkward, more than heavy, as if it was mostly hollow. The second whip hound slithered ahead of her, showing the way, glancing back with a puppy-like impatience. In a minute she was back on the tram, retracing at least part of her route, the whip hound slinking up and down the tram's interior, its eye sweeping menacingly. The tram was nearly empty this time, with only a handful of passengers at the far end of the compartment.
"What do you mean, theatre?"
Talia asked, keeping her voice low.
"You'll find a citizen," Spava said. "They're dying. You're going to operate on them." "I'm not a surgeon."
"You don't need to be. The whip hound knows what to do." The tram sped on. Towns and parks flashed by outside. Talia eyed the citizens she spotted in these rushed glimpses, strolling along paths, going in and out of white-walled buildings. Just glimpses, no chance to make out expressions or gain more than a fleeting impression of body language. But words spread quickly in a place like Shiga Mintz, where everyone shared access to the same abstraction. The air crackled with a million invisible thoughts, flashing from skull to skull. It would not be long before everyone knew something was up.
"What's wrong with them?"
"A neural episode," Spava said. "That's all we know at the moment." The tram came to a hard stop. The doors opened, the whip hound springing out through the widening gap, those few citizens on the platform jerking back as the slithering weapon made its presence known. Talia had barely caught her breath from the first run, and now she was bounding after the whip hound with the extra burden of the silver cylinder. It bumped against her hip as she jogged. A ramp led down from the tram stop into an area of manicured gardens, an agreeable enough place to spend an hour or two. Winding gravel paths, flower beds, elegant lakes and painted bandstands. Still daytime by the habitat's internal clock, yet citizens were already moving out of the park, looking back with a certain unease, even as Talia barged through them, fighting against the flow. Peacocks scattered into undergrowth, protesting at this interruption to their easy routine. Ahead was a circular intersection of 4 paths. A ring of people had formed within it, and the mood was agitated. Talia caught a flash of moving red within the ring and realized the first whiphound was establishing a widening cordon. The second whiphound, having brought her to the first, slinked back and lowered its head in a submissive posture. She opened her right fist and it sprang into the air, retracting its tail with a crack, its handle tumbling into her grasp and allowing itself to be holstered.
"Deputy Field Prefect Talia Eng," she called out, "you are under panoply observance. Step back from the whiphound, please."
"It's not letting us through," shouted a man. "Call your toy off, Prefect, before someone dies."
The man wore a green and white outfit, and he carried a white box marked with medical symbols. A woman in an identical outfit stood next to him. Parked a little way off was a luminous green fat-wheeled tricycle with the same markings.
"We were tasked to a medical emergency,"
the woman said, anger breaking through her voice.
"It's still happening, but we can't get to the citizen with that thing of yours running around."
Talia pushed through the ragged circle. The first whiphound was still circling at high speed, etching a deepening line in the gravel, a plume of dust barely having time to settle before it came around again. A determined citizen could easily have crossed the cordon between the whiphound circuits, but so far no one had summoned the nerve. Talia did not blame them for that. It took force of will to step over the cordon herself, even knowing the whiphound would never hurt her.
"Prefect,"
the female medical functionary said, with a sort of resigned calm,
"you must let us through. Whatever's happening to that citizen is our responsibility,"
Talia said, with all the authority she could muster.
"Pull back. You've done your duty here. I'll make sure that's noted."
"How can you—"
The male medic set his jaw and stepped over the cordon, glancing back at his colleague for encouragement. The whiphound sped around in its circuit, at first appearing as if it would ignore his transgression. Then, with an almost effortless insouciance, it flicked out its filament, tangling its end around his ankle, and between one instant and the next, the man was on the ground. The whiphound released him and resumed its patrol. The man tried to get to his feet, then collapsed back down again, yelling in surprise and pain.
"It's probably broken your ankle," Talia said. "When I'm finished here, you can get the medical attention you need."
She leveled her gaze at the woman.
"Don't try to help him."
Then she directed her attention to the citizen, the man at the epicenter of all this commotion. She had only given him the most cursory of glances until this moment. He was on the ground as well, lying on his side, quivering from head to toe. He was a respectable-looking individual of no particular age, hair neatly groomed, clothes smart but unostentatious, only a dusting of gravel marring their cleanliness. Talia set the silver cylinder down. She knelt next to the man, digging a knee into the gravel. His eyes were rolling back into their sockets, a fine white foam spilling from his lips. She touched a hand to his forehead and almost flinched back at the heat coming off him.
"Spava," she whispered, "I'm with him now. He seems in a bad way. If there's something I ought to know..."
"Give your second whiphound the command sequence 1, Judith Omega. It will know what to do. Meanwhile, open the containment vessel."
Her hands were starting to shake. She had some dark inkling what was about to happen. She fumbled the second whiphound back out of the holster.
"Containment for what?"
"Just get on with it, Tal."
Her lips were dry. The man's palsy was intensifying. Choking sounds were coming from his mouth.
"One, Judith,"
she began, before pausing with a terrible heaviness in her throat.
"Omega."
The whiphound jerked from her grasp, flinging out its filament. Its red eye swept the immediate locality, then locked on to the man.
"Open the vessel,"
Spava reminded her. There was a control under the handle. She pressed it and the lid unsealed itself. She set the lid aside, handled down on the gravel. The interior of the vessel was a sterile white, its walls perforated with tiny holes. The injured functionary was still calling out in distress. Beyond the cordon, the mood was turning ugly. Talia felt something sting the back of her ear, as if someone had lobbed a piece of gravel at her. She pivoted on her heel.
"I'll repeat what I said. I am Deputy Field Prefect Talia Eng. I am here on the authority of Panoply. I am sanctioned to use lethal force in the execution of my duties. A physical assault against a prefect is considered grounds for immediate reprisal."
She swallowed hard. The words had come out well enough, but she had not found quite the effortless tone of authority that she was certain Dreyfus would have used. Dreyfus would barely have bothered raising his voice. Dreyfus could sound disinterested even as he was issuing a final warning.
"Tell them the man's already as good as dead,"
Spava said.
"No local intervention's going to make any difference to his chances, but Panoply might be able to help."
The whiphound had coiled the end of its filament around the man's neck. There were two edges to that filament, a blunt one, which it could use for traction, as well as twisting bones until they broke, and a cutting edge. The second edge was a busy miracle of molecular-scale machinery. It could eat its way through almost any material it encountered. Blood swelled along a fine scarlet line as the whiphound dug deeper into the man's neck. Talia did not want to look. She gazed around in a slow arc, addressing the horrified audience. She felt like the last actor on a stage, crouching down with some wild madness in her eyes, a bloody dagger in her hand after some gruesome act of vengeance. This was not what she had seen herself doing at the start of the day.
"There's nothing you could have done for him," she said. "None of your medicine would have helped, but we can. That's why I'm here."
"Take the head," Sparva said, "and put it in the containment vessel. Seal the lid, then get yourself back to Panoply."
A large quantity of blood stained the gravel. It turned the stones shades of rust and pink, as if they were an expensive import. That said, there was less blood than she would have expected. The whiphound must have been doing something clever at the level of arteries and veins, a sort of surgery, rather than a quick, mindless decapitation. When the head rolled loose, she watched her own fingers scoop it up by the hair and place it neck down in the silver vessel. A head was a strange thing to hold, heavier than she had thought, and yet somehow not heavy enough. Then she put the lid back on the container and felt a faint scuttling going on inside, as some sort of process was initiated.
"Tell them to secure the body and freeze it," Sparva said.
"A heavy medical squad will be here shortly. Tell them the emergency is over and they need have no fears for their own safety. Tell them Panoply thanks them for their cooperation."
Talia did these things. It was her speaking. She knew it. But it might as well have been Sparva pushing his words out through her mouth. The whiphound was cleaning itself, drawing its filament back in at a slower than usual rate. She was about to fix it back in the holster when she had second thoughts. It was a long way back to the cutter, and she would need to get there with a man's head still in her possession.
"Forward scouts mode," she said. 10 meter secure zone. Lethal force authorized. Proceed."
She said it loudly, as much for the crowd's benefit as the whiphound's. The second unit scooted ahead of her. It knew the way they had come, and it would make sure there were no surprises along the way. The first whiphound broke away from its circling cordon and established a moving barricade around Talia, daring anyone to cross it. She marched forward, the vessel clunking against her thigh, now much heavier than before. No one stopped her. In another habitat, elsewhere in the Glitterband, a hooded man watched from the edge of a gathering. He was glad of the rain misting down from the distant curved ceiling of the wheel-shaped world. It had given him license to slip the hood over his head without appearing to seek anonymity. There were other hooded onlookers, as well as people under hats, ponchos, or umbrellas. Their clothes were as drab as his own, dyed in natural shades of grey and brown. Modest, stone-built homes dotted a gentle hillside, with smoke curling up from their chimneys. A water wheel turned next to a mill, and off in the distance, two woodcutters were at work with manual saws, lopping the branches off a fallen tree trunk. Further away, farm labourers and harnessed animals were working terraced fields. The gathering was taking place in a gardened commons, on an area of land that jutted out into the mill pond, next to the water wheel. There were footpaths and well-tended flower beds arranged around a collection of statues relating to significant historical events and figures from the birth of the Glitterband. The speaker was leaning on one of these statues, standing on its plinth to gain some height over his audience. The statue was a kneeling figure, a young woman in an old-fashioned spacesuit, helmet at her feet, digging her fist into fruitless soil. Her face conveyed a mixture of desperation and determination, despair vying with strength. The speaker leaned against her with laconic disregard, one arm resting on her head. He was tall and thin of frame, his dark purple clothes of a simple but formal cut. A collarless jacket hung from his slender shoulders. He had not bothered with an umbrella, poncho, or hood, but the rain glistened off his hair, upsetting the lavish wave of his blonde curls. He was nearly 60 years old, but his features were smooth and unlined, with an unsettling boyish quality. His eyes were a very pale blue, touched with coldness. The only distinguishing mark was a pale vertical scar under the right eye, a blemish so easily removed that it could only have been a deliberate decision to retain it. Dreyfus studied the face with particular attentiveness. He had seen all the images of it he could ask for, but it was something else to commit it to memory with his own eyes. If it held even the tiniest clue as to the inner workings of the mind behind it, he was determined not to miss a detail. What the man had to say was almost incidental to the recordings of similar gatherings Dreyfus had consulted, and the flow of words varied little from one performance to the next. "Good people," the man was saying, as he had done hundreds of times before, in hundreds of habitats. "Good citizens, people of Stone Hollow. 2 years ago you were all witness to the actions of Panoply in response to the so-called Aurora crisis. You'll have heard the official line, that an artificial intelligence exploited a subtle weakness in the security provisions of the Glitter Band, enabling it to gain control of the mass manufacturing infrastructure, spewing out an infestation of self-replicating war machines. They'll have led you to believe that the cost of our survival, the disarming of that threat, was the surgical destruction of 41 habitats and the loss of more than 2 million human lives. They'll tell you that as if it somehow excuses their actions, or even paints them in a flattering light. Look at us, taking such momentous decisions in your interests. Look at the hard things we had to do. What they won't tell you is those actions were only needed because of the lapses they made over many years and years, after all the trust we vested in them." He was smiling as he spoke, beaming down at his audience, the tone of his address at odds with the indictment he'd made. "Make no mistake, though. You still haven't been trusted with the truth. What was Aurora, exactly? They won't say, despite the rumours, nor will they offer any sort of explanation as to what became of that so-called artificial intelligence after the crisis was concluded. There's a reason for their evasiveness, just as there's a reason you won't hear about the catalogue of blunders that caused the whole tragic affair. It suits them to have you think the whole terrible business was somehow sprung upon us without warning, and not something that could have been avoided, had their eyes been on the task given to them." The words ought to have lost their sting by now. Panoply had been criticized before. This was nothing new. But Dreyfus knew the crisis had sprung out of a confluence of factors that could never have been anticipated. The shocking thing was not that the emergency had happened in the first place, but that it had been contained with only a modest loss of life. And, although their numbers were small compared to the civilian deaths, Panoply's own operatives had been lost, including Dreyfus's close colleagues. But all he could do now was listen. "Their failing cost millions of lives," the man was saying, "and in their betrayal of that public trust, we see now that the entire institutional framework of the Glitter Band was never anything more than a confidence trick. The security we counted on was never there in the first place. We surrendered our sovereignty to the wisdom of Panoply, and in return, they left us bereft. Our shining democratic apparatus was a hall of mirrors, designed to blind us to the truth of our own powerlessness. But it needn't be that way." He allowed himself a significant pause, beaming out at the onlookers, adjusting his leaning posture against the statue of the Americano pioneer. Now his voice lowered, becoming confiding, inviting the nearest onlookers to pull closer. "Across the Glitter Band, a new consensus is dawning. Habitats don't need Panoply. Panoply wouldn't be there for them if they did. And so they choose autonomy. They are taking back control. Control to manage the affairs of their citizens in a way that suits their needs, not those of some distant, disconnected network of overseers. Nothing can stop them.
Provided the citizens vote to secede, Panoply cannot deny them their wish. And so it has proven. In the last 6 months, 8 habitats have already declared their independent status. The prefects can't touch them. They can't even step inside without an invitation. And has the sky fallen? Has the world ended? Not in the slightest. These habitats continue to thrive. They continue to trade with the Glitter Band, with Yellowstone, and between themselves. Free movement of citizens and materials has not been endangered. Far from it, my friends. Far from it.
Dreyfus felt his neck hairs bristle against the fabric of the hood collar. He had heard enough. The point had not been to listen to the words, but to get a clearer impression of the man speaking them. Devon Garlin was not the only figure associated with the breakaway movement, but he was by far the most influential and outspoken. Where Garlin went, dissent followed. His ideas took a toxic, ineradicable hold. Dreyfus had been tracking him throughout the whole breakaway crisis, and he was in no doubt that Garland's presence and prominence was critical to the momentum of the whole affair. Something about this easygoing, affable figure pushed the citizenry to act against their own interests. It was Garlin who had taken the lead in turning public opinion against Panoply. Garlin, who had publicized the legal and institutional loopholes that permitted habitats to secede from the Glitter Band without penalty. So far, only 8 had jumped. A manageable number in Jane O'Money's view. Small habitats, for the most part, with low population loads. But Garlin was still moving from world to world, disseminating his views. Panoply, meanwhile, was keeping a close eye on the mood across the entire Glitter Band. About 20 more habitats, some of them quite large, were in open debate about whether or not to secede, and almost all of the others were at least aware of the possibility. Aumonier's response was to wait and see what happened. Dreyfus was not so willing to stand back and let events take their course. Satisfied, if not exactly reassured, he was turning to make his way back to the shuttle dock, when a change in Garland's tone snagged his attention. "Wait, friend! I'm not done yet! You wouldn't want to miss the best bit, would you?" Dreyfus ought to have kept walking. Others had already begun to drift away from the gathering, so it was not as if he had called attention to himself just by leaving. He should have kept walking, not slowly turned around to face Garland, knowing he was the subject of the statement. Dreyfus said nothing. He looked over the heads of those before him to the man leaning on the statue. "The rain's easing, friend. You can drop the hood." The friendly tone of the words only brought out the steel beneath him. "Go on. There's no need to be coy about your identity. I knew who you were from the moment you arrived." Dreyfus left his hood up. He had hoped not to speak, because to do so would draw exactly the scrutiny he had meant to avoid. But Garlin had rendered his efforts futile. "I just came to hear you speak, like everyone else." "Are you going to introduce yourself, friend?" There was a beat, no more than that, before Garlin continued. "I'll do it for you. Good people, good citizens. This is Tom Dreyfus, or should I say Prefect Dreyfus. He walks among us. Senior Prefect Tom Dreyfus of Panoply, one of the very men who brought us to the brink of disaster 2 years ago. I wonder why he's so keen to preserve his anonymity." Garlin let out a snigger. "You couldn't have expected to pass unnoticed, Tom." "I'm here as a civilian," Dreyfus said, doing his best not to raise his voice, not to sound in any way perturbed. "I wanted to hear what you had to say."
"And what did you make of it, before some other business called you away?"
"You make a very persuasive case." There was a murmur of conversation from the onlookers, but only Garlin and Dreyfus were speaking at a normal volume. Dreyfus prickled under the attention, feeling cast in a role he had never asked for.
"You see how it works now," Garlin said, nodding out at his audience. "We've got them rattled. Rattled enough that they send out people like Dreyfus to mingle with us and attempt to undermine our efforts. That's why you're here, isn't it, Tom?"
I told you why I was here. You call yourself the voice of the people, the spokesperson for the common citizen. Why shouldn't I be interested?
Is that all it is? Just innocent interest?
Dreyfus looked around at his unwelcome audience. Don't allow yourselves to be taken in by him, he said, addressing no one in particular, but making eye contact with as many as possible. He's not the common man he makes out. His birth name was Julius Devon Garlin Voy, the wealthy son of Marlon and Aliel Voy. Ask him about the Shell House. He was raised in a private estate in Chasm City, not in the Glitter Band. He's been pampered from the moment he was born, and now he wants to tear apart the very society that welcomed him with open arms, like a spoilt brat breaking his playthings. Someone flicked down his hood, and the last traces of the rain drizzled down against his scalp. Dreyfus turned again, showing no haste or anger, not even seeking eye contact with the person who had dropped his hood.
"Let him leave,"
Garlin said, pushing a false magnanimity into his words. "He's within his rights. We won't stop him doing as he chooses. We're not the ones who fall back on force and intimidation in the face of our enemies, nor are we the ones who say that a man must be defined by his origins." Dreyfus began to walk away from the gathering. He had been near the back of the audience, but there were still a few stragglers to push past. They moved out of his way, grudgingly. But he had only taken a few steps when something tripped him. It was sudden, and he hit the ground hard enough to knock the wind from his lungs. For a moment, probably no more than a second, although it felt longer, wet grass pushed into his face, prickling into his nose and eyes. He forced himself up. The ground here was scuffed and muddy, and his hands came away smeared with grass and soil. He had probably been tripped deliberately, but there was an outside chance it was just an accident. Dreyfus was pushing himself to his feet when Garlin bounded over, kneeling slightly to bring their faces level.
"Let me help you up, Tom."
"There's no need."
"You should watch your step. No one wants to see a prefect face down in the grass like that."
Garlin braced a hand under Dreyfus's elbow and made a theatrical show of grunting as he helped him up.
"My, heavy. I didn't know they let prefects carry around so much weight."
Dreyfus wiped his hands on his knees, the fabric absorbing the stain into itself.
"You and I aren't done."
Cold blue eyes regarded Dreyfus carefully. Finally, Garlin gave a nod.
"I doubt very much that we are."
Chapter 2. Near the outer orbit of the Glitter Band, deep inside a small pumpkin-shaped asteroid, lay a room reached through a pair of heavy bronze doors. Hung on massive hinges, each door was engraved with the symbol of a clenched, gauntleted fist. Beyond the deliberate anachronism of the doors was a windowless chamber, its curved walls clad in many spotless layers of varnished wood. The room's lighting was subdued, with most of the illumination coming from the ever-changing tactical readouts on its long oval-shaped table, as well as the soft glow of the solid orrery, ticking away to itself in a corner. The orrery was an evolving, real-time, three-dimensional representation of the entire flow of worlds in the Glitter Band, as well as the planet they orbited. The doors hinged shut behind Talia. She breathed in, forcing calm upon herself. The air in the room, based on the few occasions she had been inside it, always seemed to lie heavy on her lungs, as if it carried some of the varnish with it.
"Take a seat, Eng. This needn't take long."
There were 20 seats around the table, of which a dozen were presently occupied. There was Jane O'Munier, of course, and flanking her were a mixture of senior prefects, internal prefects, field prefects, and a few supernumerary analysts with tactical security ratings. Talia took the high-backed chair, facing the Supreme Prefect. O'Monier's face was underlit by the readouts on the area of table before her, and they cast colours and patterns across her chin and cheekbones. After a silence, Talia ventured to speak.
"I haven't had time to submit a field report, ma'am."
"There'll be no need in this instance, Eng. Your conduct was entirely satisfactory. It was an unusual development, and you reacted well.
Talia nodded once, her hand settled before her in her lap. She wondered if the words, unusual development, had ever been delivered with more dry understatement.
I'm sorry about the medical orderly. He was just trying to do his work.
Don't worry about him, said Senior Prefect Gaston Clearmountain, sitting to the right of Aumanier. He was lucky to get away with just a broken ankle.
Perhaps he'll take it as a lesson, said Senior Prefect Lillian Beaudry,
who was sitting in her customary position to the left of Aumanier.
I hope we don't have to teach too many of them, Field Prefect Spava Bancal said, or it could get messy.
It's messy enough already, Aumanier said, nodding in sympathy with Spava, who had taken his usual position between Beaudry and one of the supernumerary analysts. His seat was slightly elevated compared to the others, bringing his eye level close to the other operatives.
The heavy medicals attended him. Do we have an update on his condition?
No lasting complications, said Internal Prefect Ingvar Tench, who was sitting on the extreme right of the oval table.
There was a silence.
And the other men?
Talia asked. Aumanier looked puzzled by the question.
Which other man? The man whose head you had me bring back?
Talia answered. Aumanier's voice remained level, her posture poised and still, hardly any part of her face moving except her lips.
The man's condition was far beyond anything the local medics were equipped to treat. We didn't even let them try.
Spava Bancal smiled, or rather produced the nearest thing to a smile that a hyper-pig could.
It wasn't about killing or saving him. It was about evidential preservation.
It was just a seizure, she said, looking from face to face for a clue. Something went wrong in his brain and he started having some sort of episode. Why is that any concern of ours?
You did well, Aumanier said, as if they had just spooled back to the start of the conversation.
You may continue your work with the polling corps, according to the agreed schedule.
Begging your pardon, ma'am, Talia said, but you were expecting it, weren't you? That's why that container was in my ship, just waiting to be used. You were expecting to have to cut someone's head off. She watched the faces of the others, measuring their reactions. None of them looked comfortable, but they were doing their best to make this seem like routine business.
Let me be blunt with you, Eng,
Aumanier said. Today you brushed against the periphery of something beyond your security clearance. I won't insult your intelligence by suggesting otherwise. You are correct in your assumption that certain operational provisions had already been made.
Well, ma'am,
Talia began.
Speaking,
Aumanier said, softening the remark with the mildest hint of a smile.
You are trusted, Eng, and expected to execute your duties with due regard to matters of security and secrecy. I am confident you will do so. But just so there is no ambiguity, there will be no mention of this matter from the moment you leave this room. You will discuss it with no one, regardless of rank. You will not allude to it in the vaguest of terms. You will conduct no queries pertaining to this business in any regard whatsoever. You are entitled to your curiosity. I would think less of you if you were not curious. For now, though, you will proceed as if nothing unusual had happened today. In time you may be privy to more information, but not now,
and not for the foreseeable future. It's something big, then, Talia thought. Something they haven't cleared up yet. Something they don't know when they'll clear up. Another emergency on the order of the last one.
If I could help, ma'am.
You can't, Eng, Aumanier said. Or rather, you can, by putting this entire matter out of your mind. Is that clear? Talia felt the pressure of the other faces, staring at her own.
It is, ma'am,
she answered, forcing herself to meet their eyes, to show confidence rather than cowardness.
Then that will be all, Eng, Aumanier said.
In the area of Panoply, they still called the sleep lab, Dr. Demikoff's face loomed behind the distorting surface of tinted glassware. He was adjusting some valve or temperature regulator on the side of a cryogenic vessel. Inside the vessel, looking oddly shrunken, was the severed head. Behind Spavel Bancal, their own reflections ghosting above his own, stood Senior Prefect Gaston Clearmountain, and Supreme Prefect Jane Omanier.
Well?
Omanier asked, after the silence had grown interminable. What's the verdict, Doctor? You're the expert on heads, or so I'm told. Some flicker of amusement crossed Demikov's lantern-jawed face as he straightened up from the vessel and the bench's worth of medical systems surrounding it. I generally prefer working with heads that have at least a fighting chance of revival. The head was upright, fixed into some sort of life support collar, caged by columns of rising bubbles. It looked waxy and inert, more like a casting than something that had only recently belonged to a living individual.
How does it compare?
Spava asked.
The usual mush, Prefect Bankal, just a little less cooked than the others.
You have such a delicate way with words,
Clear Mountain muttered.
Nothing recoverable?
Omanier asked.
I haven't cracked it open yet, but the scans tell me all I need to know. Neural patterns are scrambled beyond recognition, and the implants are reduced to a few micrograms of metallic slag.
This is our best chance to date,
Omanier said.
If there's anything in this head, the tiniest clue, we need it.
I'll go through the motions, Demikov said resignedly.
One question, Spava said. Do we know anything about the melter?
He heard Clear Mountain sniff of displeasure. Something tightened in Omanier's already taut features before she spoke.
The citizen was Antal Bronner, 82 years old, born and died in the Shigamint's spindle, spent less than a decade living in other habitats.
Priors?
Spava asked.
He looks clean,
Omanier said.
A private trader in out-system goods, specializing in exo-art. No scandals, no major insolvencies, just the ups and downs of any small-time broker.
Living associates?
Asked Spava.
One wife, Giselin Bronner. She's been told that her husband died in a sudden medical event. She'll have questions, undoubtedly, but we won't be able to offer her all the answers.
We could sequester her as a warm witness,
Clear Mountain said. Omanier gave a sharp shake of her head.
No, tact is key for now. I'll arrange a soft interview on her territory, just enough to see if she's hiding anything.
You could always send Aang, Spava offered.
After I made it clear she isn't to speak a word of this to anyone? Omanier asked.
You had to for security's sake, but that's only because she hasn't been brought on board. If she understood the situation, she'd be just as keen as the rest of us to keep this under wraps. If she was given a pangolin shot, she could be up to speed by tomorrow, another pair of eyes and ears we badly need.
And another risk of a leak, Clear Mountain said.
She's no more likely to leak than you or I, Gaston,
Spava said.
Unless you still believe Jason Aang wasn't totally absolved of wrongdoing.
I never mentioned her father, Clear Mountain said.
You didn't need to. You've made it as plain as can be that you'll never let Talia step out of his shadow.
Gentlemen, Omanier said softly, let's not bicker. The fact of the matter, though, is that Gaston is correct. We've kept this watertight until now, by confining it to the highest security rankings, including our good colleague Dr. Demikov. Talia may well be trustworthy.
I don't doubt that she is. But every additional operative brings the risk of an accidental slip. Need I remind you that our enemies, opportunists like Devon Garlin, are circling like sharks, waiting for just such an opportunity.
I still say she could be an asset, Spava said.
And in time she may well be, Omanier allowed. But for now, you must set aside your personal feelings of protectiveness towards Aang. It could have been any operational field who had to bring back that head. Would you have been so keen to bring one of the others into the investigation, if you hadn't worked closely with them under Dreyfus?
Spava knew better than to lie.
Perhaps you're right.
She was required to execute a task in the line of duty,
Clear Mountain replied.
That's where it ends for her. She's a competent operative, but at the end of the day she's just another field. That won't cause any difficulties, will it, Prefect Bankal?
None at all, Sparva said.
You acted without my authority,
Omanie said, without even a token attempt at pleasantries. Dreyfus faced her across the table. He had come directly from the docking bay, not even taking the time to step through a wash wall.
Your authority wasn't required, he answered. When I go to the hospice to see Valerie, I do so as a free citizen. This was no different.
Don't split legalistic hairs with me. Devon Garlin isn't our concern. Don't force us into a position where he becomes so. I think we've already passed that point.
Omanie studied him with a faint air of exasperation, of lofty expectations in grave danger of being undermined.
Garland's breakaway movement will lose steam. It'll only take a small crisis, a minor economic downturn, to have those rogue habitats scuttling back into the fold.
You wouldn't have said that 2 years ago.
Things change.
Dreyfus leaned forward.
Garlin isn't just another flash in the pan, Blowhard. Those 8 habitats aren't rushing to rejoin us, and there are at least 20 more on the verge of breaking away.
These are small numbers.
Dreyfus offered open palms, traces of yellowish dirt still lodged under his fingernails. I wanted to see him for real, not just on compads and screens, to get a measure of the man. Omanie sighed slowly, clearly aware she was being drawn into a conversation against her will.
And what gems of insight did you bring back?
Mainly that I don't like self-professed men of the people who keep quiet about being born into one of the richest families in Chasm City.
It wasn't all roses. He was only 16 when Nalia died. Tough for an only child. Especially the way Marlon was fading, losing his grip on things. Yet Julius picked himself up, made his own way beyond the estate and Chasm City, and found a role for himself in life.
To rack and ruin.
Half a smile bent her lips.
I don't have to like the man, or believe in his objectives, to see that he's made something of himself beyond the umbrella of the Voy name.
There's something else going on here. I'd done nothing to draw attention to myself, nothing to call out my presence, and yet he knew I was there.
I know. I saw it on the public feeds. Panoply sends spy to eavesdrop on public gathering.
He'd been aware of me all along, and yet I'd barely shown my face. I went to Stone Hollow by civilian shuttle. No one gave me a second glance at any point in my journey.
What are you saying?
He still picked up on my presence. He sensed there was someone at the gathering who didn't belong.
For all you know, he wasn't aware of you until the moment you turned your back on him. Then he ran an identity query on you and realized you weren't carrying implants. From there, it's only a small step to guessing you were a Panoply operative.
And from there, he guessed my name.
Like it or not, the Aurora affair made you something of a public figure.
Omanie angled her head to one side, conveying at least a measure of sympathy.
Don't make more of this than you need to. Let Garlin be my headache, not yours.
As if you didn't have enough to be getting on with.
I take it you heard about Eng's little mission?
Dreyfus nodded, glad the matter of Garlin had been set aside for the time being. I saw Sparva in the docking bay. He told me what happened. Do you think it's the break we've been hoping for?
Omanie looked equivocal. Demikov doesn't seem very optimistic, even for Demikov.
There has to be a pattern, a causal factor. We just haven't seen it yet.
In other words, more deaths would be helpful.
Dreyfus leaned back, evaluating a risky idea before he put it into words.
Might I say something?
You're going to anyway?
Assign the polling core upgrades to a DFP-1 and put Talia Eng onto a full-time investigation of the deaths. Give her a pangolin boost and assign a squad, if need be.
I can't risk it. I've already been over this with Clear Mountain and Bankarm. It's not that I don't trust Eng, but if so much as a word of this gets out, I'll have a mass panic on my hands.
You already have witnesses.
Civilians who aren't sure what happened, and who aren't aware of any larger pattern of incidents. That's how it'll stay,
provided we maintain the present security arrangements.